Greetings to everyone here. It's nice to see the full house. Caleb and Miranda and Roland back there. Most of you know, as Elder Allen just announced, Feast of Tabernacles is only 8 weeks away. I'm excited about it. I hope all of you are as well. But we're going to have many activities, and it's going to be a blessing, I believe, for all who can come and join us for this time. So I pray all of you here plan to join us, and I pray many more perhaps listening on tape. For today's message, I've chosen a topic that we don't often discuss. This topic is one of the most important commandments found in Yahweh's word, but yet you hardly hear about this command. We know that Judah's refusal to obey this command led to her captivity in Babylon by the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. And we also know that our refusal to obey this command as a nation has led to our soil and fields being depleted of its nutrients. Like Yahweh's other laws, this command is for the benefit of man. It's for our benefit. We know that when we obey Yahweh, we reap the blessings that come forth from that obedience. If you have yet to know what I'm talking about, I'm speaking about Yahweh's sabbatical year, the year of rest. As I've said, the sabbatical is one of the most important, but yet, sadly, one of the most neglected of all of his commands. The sabbatical is a lot like Yahweh's dietary food laws. Doctors now know that eating fatty foods and swine and other unclean animals are detrimental to man's health. We know this medically, scientifically. More and more for this reason do we find churchianity preaching and teaching Yahweh's dietary food laws. I saw a minister recently teaching the dietary food laws in a nominal church, proclaiming the benefits of Yahweh's law. In this way, the sabbatical is no different. Again, as it is with all of Yahweh's commandments, it's to our benefit if we obey. It's to our benefit. In this message, I want to look at the sabbatical, and with that, the Jubilee, and read about what this time includes and how it relates to you and I as Yahweh's people today. So let's open up to Yahweh's word. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 1. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 1, it says, "And Yahweh spoke to Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, When you come into the land which I will give you, then you shall keep the land a Sabbath to Yahweh. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyards, and gather in the fruits of it. And in the seventh year you shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to Yahweh. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyards. That which grows itself of your harvest you shall not reap, and the grapes of your undressed vine you shall not gather. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land, and the Sabbath of the land shall be for food for you and for your servant and for your maid and for your hired servant and for your stranger who sojourns with you and for your cattle and for the beasts that are in your land. All the increase of it be for food." As we're commanded to take one day off and rest, as we're here observing today, Yahweh commands the same for the land, as we're told to rest so that we can rejuvenate, so that we can rest from the week. Yahweh commands the same every seventh year for the land. He says that we're to abstain from planting and harvesting the fields. Why? Why does Yahweh command that we allow the land to lay fallow every seventh year? What's the purpose? Why? You see, in Yahweh's infinite wisdom, he understands more than we do. He understood that if we allowed the land to lay fallow or empty every seventh year, that the nutrients of the land would rejuvenate, would replenish, would be restored. In the last few years, I've seen many studies showing the cause and effect of farming without obeying the sabbatical, how it depletes the nutrients. If you'd ask most farmers, most would agree that it's best to allow the land to lay fallow or empty every few years, but simply refuse to do so because of the almighty dollar profit. Because most farmers choose to ignore the sabbatical or crop rotation or something to that degree, most of our vegetables and fruits suffer today from a lack of nutrients Again, this is a fact that's been proven true from numerous studies throughout the years. Let's drop down to verse 20 and continue reading here, Leviticus 25, verse 20. It says, And you shall say, what shall we eat the seventh year? Behold, we shall not sow nor gather nor increase. Then I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year. And you shall bring forth fruit for, what does it say? 3 years. And you shall sow the eighth year and eat of the fruits and old store until the ninth year, until its fruits come in. And you shall eat the old store. Yahweh promised Israel that if she would obey and keep the sabbatical, that she would be blessed with an overabundance of food. Yahweh said that so much so that 1 year's crop would last for 3 long years. When I read this passage, I think about the loaves and the fishes that Yahshua fed the thousands with. You know, nothing is impossible with Yahweh. Nothing. And I believe and have faith that if we obey Yahweh's command, whether it's the feast, whether it's the Sabbath, the dietary food laws, our job, whatever it is, that we'll receive blessings if we obey. For example, in Malachi, Yahweh told Judah to prove him by tithing and to watch the doors of heaven open and to pour forth such a blessing that they could possibly not receive. Let's continue with verse 23 here. Verse 23. And the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the land of your possession you shall grant a redemption for the land. If your brother has become poor and sell some of his possession, then shall his kinsman that is next to him come and shall redeem that which his brother has sold. And if a man has no one to redeem it and has grown rich and finds sufficient to redeem it, then let him reckon the years of the sale of it and restore the excess of the to the man to whom he sold it, and he shall return to his possession. And if he is not able to get back for himself, then that which he has sold shall remain in the hand of him that has bought it until the year of Jubilee. And in the year of Jubilee it shall go out, he shall return to his possession. So Yahweh in verse 23 told Israel that the land would not be sold forever. It was not for sale. And furthermore, he said that the land was his. Think about what Yahweh was saying here. Think about the implications of what's written here. What we see here is that the land ultimately belonged to Yahweh. It belonged to him. And that he only allowed Israel to use it. It was a lease. He allowed Israel to use it, but it belonged to him. For just a moment, let's apply this to you and I. Do our belongings and wealth truly belong to us? What about our bodies? Do our bodies belong to us? What about our breath? Does our breath, or ruach, belong to us? The fact is, all that we have belongs to Yahweh. There is nothing that truly belongs to us. Nothing. Everything we are and have belongs to the one who gave it, and that is our Father in heaven, Yahweh. I believe that this is precisely the reason why Yahweh gave the command that the land should be returned on the Jubilee to the original owners if it wasn't redeemed before that time, because they could redeem it before the year of Jubilee. But if not, it had to go out, return in the Jubilee. If we see that in this passage, if a person sold his land and he could not redeem that land, that it would be given back in the Jubilee. And if he could redeem it, it says that the price would be reconciled from the years of Jubilee. So Yahweh here has a plan, even with the exchange of real estate and land. This is what Boaz did when he married Ruth. He redeemed all that his kinsmen had. That was the issue. He had to redeem not only the land, but Ruth. And we know that Boaz did that, and he was blessed for it. Let's drop down to verse 29 and continue reading there with verse 29. It says, and if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it is sold. For a full year shall he have the right of redemption. And if it is not redeemed within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city shall be made sure and perpetually or forever. To him that bought it, throughout the generations. It shall not go out in the Jubilee. This is a distinction, a difference here from what we've seen thus far. 31, but the houses of the villages which have no walls round about them shall be reckoned with the fields of the country. They shall be redeemed, and they shall go out in the Jubilee. Now we see here that there was a difference between houses built in a walled city versus houses built in the villages without walls. Houses that were built in the walled cities could be sold, but were not released during the Jubilee. We also see that when a sale did occur in a walled city, that the original owner and the buyer had a set time to buy back that house. Now, according to some sources, including the pulpit commentary, the phrase space of a full year should really be rendered, which we find in verse 30, during a fixed time. And this fixed time was determined with the original owner and the buyer of the home. So they determined if 6 months, a year, whatever it was, and they could buy that home back within that time, within that walled city. And if not, it was the buyer's forever. And it did not go out in the Jubilee. Now, why was there a difference between a house in a walled city versus a house in a village without walls? Most speculate, and Yahweh's word really doesn't say, but most speculate that the villages or farm land was strictly that of divided from Yahweh in the beginning when he divided the land, versus the cities in the wall, or the walled cities, was more or less built by human industry. It wasn't divided by Yahweh. It was developed by man, therefore exempt from the Jubilee. Look at verse 32 now. Verse 32, it says, nevertheless, the cities of the Levites, the houses of the Levites of their possession, may the Levites redeem at any time. And if one of the Levites redeems, then the house that was sold in the city in his possession shall go out in the Jubilee. For the houses of the cities of the Levites are their possession among the children of Israel. But the field of their suburbs, of their cities, may not be sold, for it is theirs forever, a perpetual possession, it says. Here we see that the Levites sold a possession, that they could redeem it at any time, even if that possession, that house, was in a walled city. Remember that the Levites had no inheritance. Now why not? What was their inheritance? It's written that Yahweh was their inheritance. So they received no physical inheritance. Instead of their own land or physical inheritance, they received or were given 48 cities amongst the other tribes, which they could sell and redeem at any time, with the exception, it says, of a field within the suburbs. Now, why is this? Why did Yahweh restrict the sale of the Levites, of their fields and their suburbs? I believe that Yahweh forbade this because of two reasons. Number one, the fields were where the Levites kept their flocks, so it was really their livelihood. And number two, Yahweh wanted to prevent infighting with land ownership between the Levites and the other 11 tribes, since they were mingled together. You see, they did not have their own inheritant land. They were mingled in with the other 11 tribes. So to prevent infighting, I believe anyway, Yahweh restricted them from selling their suburbs, their fields. Go to Deuteronomy now, Deuteronomy chapter 15. We're going to look at a few other laws regarding the sabbatical. And we're going to see one here that I believe impacts us today. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Verse 1, it says, at the end of every 7 years you shall make a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release that which he has lent to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because Yahweh's release has been proclaimed. Of a foreigner you may exact it, but whatever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release. However, there shall be no poor with you, for Yahweh will surely bless you in the land which Yahweh your Elohim gives you for an inheritance to possess. What we see here is all part of the sabbatical. On every seventh year, Yahweh commanded that Israel was to forgive each other's debts, was to forgive each other's debts. Now, I've been asked if this would also apply to to us, I believe that it would and does. If we loan money to a brother or sister in the faith and the sabbatical comes, I believe that we have an obligation as Yahweh's people to release that debt. I don't see any reason that this law would not apply to us. Notice in verse 3 that this provision only applied to the Israelites. It did not apply to a foreigner. I believe that this same stipulation holds true for those Messiah. Because we are a family in Yahshua, right? Of course we are. We're a family, just as if the Israelites were all part of a family. It's no different for us. You know, there are several examples of laws that we can look at that work this way. For example, Deuteronomy chapter 14 talks about an animal dying of itself. And Yahweh restricted the Levites of eating that animal, said you can't do it. But he said you can give it to a foreigner. You see, there's a different standard between the Levites and a foreigner. We can see that here with the sabbatical. Even in the New Testament, we know that there were differences between those and the Messiah and the world. For example, we know that we're not to judge the world. Yahweh judges the world, but we know that we are to judge those in the assembly, those Messiah. There is a distinction. There is a difference. Let's continue with verse 5. If only you diligently listen to the voice of Yahweh Elohim to observe to do all this commandment which I command you this day, for Yahweh Elohim will bless you as he promised you, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow, and you shall rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. You see, this is what happens when we obey Yahweh. We're blessed. We're blessed because we listen and we live our lives in a way that's pleasing to Yahweh's word. And again, these laws are beneficial to us. It's beneficial to man. Verse 7, if there be with you a poor man, one of your brethren within any of your gates in your land, which Yahweh your Elohim gives you, you should not burden your heart or shut up your hand from the poor brother. Listen to this. This is important. This is a message not only for Israel, but for us too. For us too. Verse 8, but you shall surely open your hand to him, and you shall surely lend him enough for his need and that which he wants. Beware of that. Is not a base thought in your heart, saying the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye is evil against your brother, and you give him nothing, and he cries to Yahweh against you, and it is sin to you, because you refused. Your heart wasn't right before Yahweh. You shall surely give him, and your heart shall not grieve when you give to him, because for this thing Yahweh Elohim will bless you in all your work and in all that you put your hand to do. For the poor will never cease out of the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall surely open your hand to your brother, to the needy, and to the poor in your land. Many people see Yahweh's laws as a negative and a bunch of don'ts. But here we see a law that's positive, and a law that's designed to help those in need. Yahweh says here that when we lend to our neighbors, that we shouldn't think about the sabbatical. In other words, say that a brother would come to us, knowing that the sabbatical was a year away, and they needed some help. They needed a loan, or whatever it was. They needed help. According to Yahweh's law, we cannot deny that brother or sister that help, loan, whatever it is, because of the timing of the sabbatical. Yahweh said, don't do this. And he said, if you do, it's sin. In my last message, I spoke about giving and helping our fellow man. And in that message, we saw that when we give, we should give with all simplicity, as Paul says in Romans chapter 12. Give with all simplicity, all liberality. When we give, we shouldn't begrudge that person or think evil of that person. Again, the fact that we see this command shows Yahweh's concern for the poor, the needy, even in the Old Testament. You know, many people believe this is a New Testament thought, helping others, helping the needy, grace, faith. None of these are Old Testament or New Testament concepts. They're old. They began here in the Old. Let's look at verse 12 now. Verse 12. If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you and serves you 6 years, then in the seventh year shall let him go free from you. And when you let him go free from you. You shall not let him go empty. So you're to give them something, much like the Egyptians did when the Israelites left Goshen. That was a different circumstance. But they were given. They were given jewelry. And here we see the same thing. Give them things of substance, so they don't go out empty. Verse 14, you shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of the threshing floor, and out of your wine press. So we're to give them an abundance. We're to be giving. Giving, that's an attribute, you know, of Yahweh's people. As Yahweh Elohim has blessed you, shall give to him. And ye shall remember that you were a bondman in the land of Egypt, and Yahweh Elohim redeemed you. Therefore I command you this thing today. And it shall be, if he says to you, I will not go out from you because he loves you and your house, because he is well with you, then you shall take an awl and thrust it through his ear at the door. And this was a practice with old Israel. They just refused, saying, no, I want to stay with you. You know, I've grown close to you, and I want to stay here. Yahweh was saying, okay, if that's the case, you're to do this. And it was a sign to show that this person was the master's for life. He belonged to his master because he loved his master. It wasn't slavery as an abuse. He loved his master. And it says, and also in your maidservant, you shall do likewise. Verse 18, you shall not seem hard to you when you let him go free from you. For you, for to the double of your hire of the hireling has he served you 6 years, and Yahweh Elohim will bless you and all that you do. So we see here the law of allowing the servants to go free. The servants, to the Hebrew slaves, basically. Servants would probably be a better word, though, than slave. Now, many people have a false impression on what a Hebrew servant or slave was. I don't believe that Hebrew slaves is comparable to slavery that we once had in this nation. For example, not only were there laws that forbade maltreatment of Hebrew slaves, we see here that they were released every 6 years. And it was up to them whether they wanted to stay or not, not up to the master. He had to let them go. Now, if the servant wanted to stay, again, because he loved his master, he could stay. And that alone shows that there was a different relationship there than what we saw in this nation. Okay, let's go to 2 Corinthians now. 2 Corinthians chapter 36. I want to ask you something here. Is Yahweh's sabbatical important? Is it important? How important is it? Is it important to Yahweh? Is it important to us? How important is it? Let's find out. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. Let's start at verse 11. I want to get some context here. So we're going to look at verse 11. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 11. It says, Zedekiah was 21 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh, his Elohim. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, speaking from the mouth of Yahweh. No, again, humility and pride go so far with Yahweh's people. We need to remove the pride and be humbled people. 13, and he also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear by Elohim. But he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to Yahweh, the Elohim of Israel. He just wouldn't do it. Even when he was confronted with Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, he would not turn to Yahweh. He simply refused. Verse 14, moreover, all the chiefs of the priests and the people trespassed very greatly after all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of Yahweh, which he had hallowed in Jerusalem. It's a lot like our nation today. We see a lot of so-called diversity. It's a pollution. It's an abomination to Yahweh. Verse 15, and Yahweh, the Elohim of your father, sent to them by his messengers, rising up early and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of Elohim and despised his word and scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of Yahweh arose against the people, till there was no remedy. There was nothing he could do at that point. He tried and tried, and people just simply refused to listen. They were rebellious and they refused, a lot like our nation again. So Yahweh says at that point there was no remedy. There was nothing that he could do. Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldeans, Babylonians, who killed their young men with a sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young men or virgin, old man, or gray-headed. He gave them all into his hand. And all the vessels of the house of Elohim, great and small, the treasures of the house of Yahweh, and the treasures of the king and his princesses, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burnt the house of Elohim and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burnt all the palaces of it with fire and destroyed all the good vessels of it. And then that had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the king of Persia, which we know historically that the Persians allowed Israel, Judah, to go free, to rebuild their temple, to rebuild Jerusalem under Nehemiah and Ezra. Verse 21, here's the key passage here. Verse 21, to fulfill, now why did this happen? Yahweh says, to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. For as long as it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. 70 years. Now notice why Yahweh allowed the Babylonians to conquer Judah. According to verse 21, it was because Judah neglected and refused to keep the sabbatical year. So from this example, would you not agree that the sabbatical is important to Yahweh? It is important to Yahweh, and it should be important to us. I believe that few people realize how important the Sabbath, the sabbatical Sabbath, really is. We see here that the land would remain desolate until the sabbaticals that Judah neglected had rest, were complete in number. Now some ask, should we plant grass, shrubs, or other plants in the sabbatical? I wanted to wait until this point to answer this, because I believe the solution is here in verse 21. In verse 21, the word desolate is from the Hebrew word shamem, which means to shun growth. Or devastate. Again, that's to shun growth or devastate. This word shamem seems to indicate that the land should not be used at all, should totally be allowed to lay fallow or desolate. Notice that Jeremiah prophesied that Judah would be in exile until the land had enjoyed her rest. We see here that Jeremiah prophesied that Judah would be exiled for 70 long years. Let's turn to Jeremiah for a moment. Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 9. Chapter 25 of Jeremiah. Look at verse 9. It says, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north. It says, Yahweh will send to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. You see, he was a servant. Why? Because he was accomplishing Yahweh's will. He used Persia in the same way. Matter of fact, to call the king of Persia, I think, a savior. Because he saved his people. But Yahweh uses other nations, and I believe perhaps he used the terrorists now that we have, that we're now facing in this same way. This nation refuses to do what's right, so Yahweh will remedy that problem. And will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants of it and against all these nations all around, and I will utterly destroy them and will make them an astonishment and a hissing, and a perpetual, everlasting desolations. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of mirth, and the voice of gladness, and the voice of bridegroom, and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones, and the light of the lamp. And this whole land shall be in desolation, and in astonishment. And these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. As we see here, Judah was in Babylon for 70 long years, a year for every sabbatical neglected, meaning that they neglected 490 years of the sabbatical. Think about it in this way. This nation has been in existence only half that time, and consider how we've depleted the nutrients in the soil of this nation. You know, in many ways, Judah's captivity served a practical purpose. It was for a reason. It allowed the land to rest, therefore allowing it to replenish its nutrients. You see, when we refuse to obey Yahweh, when we refuse to listen, Yahweh often forces us to obey in one form or another. For example, when the 10 tribes refused to repent and forsook Yahweh, he forsook them and allowed the Assyrians, one of the most ruthless nations of that time, to remove them from the land. We should never forget that when it comes to judgment, when it comes to justice, Yahweh promises that he will repay anyone who believes that they can outdo or deceive our Maker, Yahweh, will have a rude awakening. And Yahweh sends forth his judgment upon this earth. Know this, when it comes to rebellion, Yahweh won't be mocked. Judah decided to ignore the sabbatical for 490 years. And as a result, Yahweh removed them from their land. He says, fine, if you're not going to do this, if you will not obey, he says, I will remove you and the land will enjoy her rest. Now, since we've looked at and I think understand the sabbatical, let me ask, how do we know the proper timing of the sabbatical? When do we know the correct year of the sabbatical? Now, we know that there isn't a specific date mentioned in Yahweh's word for the sabbatical, but we do have a fairly recent sabbatical date in the book of Maccabees. Now, understand that even though the book of Maccabees isn't an inspired book, as a Genesis or Exodus, it is a historical book and can be, for the most part, be relied upon historically. In 1 Maccabees chapter 6, we find the Jews in a vicious war with the Greeks, specifically the Seleucid army, one of the four generals of Alexander. And we see that this war took place during a sabbatical. In 1 Maccabees chapter 6, verse 49, it says, but made peace with the people of Beth-Zur, and they excavated the town because they had no provisions there to withstand a siege, since it was a sabbatical year for the land. In verse 53, it says, but they had no food in storage because it was the seventh rest, or seventh year. Now, according to 1 Maccabees 6, this occurred in 162 BCE. In addition to what we find in 1 Maccabees, we also find additional evidence for this from Flavius Josephus, the Jewish historian. In Antiquities of the Jews, Josephus states this, there came around the year in which the Jews are wont to remain inactive, for they observe this custom every seventh year, just as on the seventh day. Also, Josephus, in his Wars of the Jews, states the year of rest came on upon which the Jews rest every seventh year, as they do on every seventh day. Now, with both of these events recorded by Josephus, most attribute the dates of 135 to 134 BCE, which would correspond with what we find in 1 Maccabees with 162 BCE. If we would count from either of these two dates offered by Josephus or 1 Maccabees, we would find that the last sabbatical was observed between 2001 and 2002. Most of you probably remember this. Now, when we count from these dates to our common era, it's important that we understand one point, and that is that there was no year zero in our modern calendar. I'd like to read to you two small quotes, one from the University of North Carolina and the other from CNN. Here's what the mathematics and science department says at University of North Carolina. Quote, the traditional system of numbering years has no year zero. The first year of the first millennium was 1 AD. The year before that is numbered 1 BC. The next is from CNN. Eric Engelman is the author, and it was written in 2001 with the millennium controversy. And it says the real starting point is January 1st, 2001, not January 1st, 2000. This discrepancy goes back to the 6th century monk named Dionysius, or Dennis the Little. Under orders from Pope St. John I in 525, Dennis drew up a new timeline, the one in use today, that begins with Messiah rather than the foundation of Rome. The fact Dennis did not start his calendar with zero has been a source of consternation for centuries. It was, however, not his fault. The concept of zeros, as defined by Hindu and Arab mathematicians, that's where zero came from, Hindu influence mainly, would not be introduced to Europe for another 250 years or so. So Dennis began with January 1st, AD 1. Now, since we know that there was no year zero, we can count from either of the dates offered by Josephus or Maccabees and come to 2002. And I had a form up here. I put this together. Most of you should have a copy of this a few days ago in Excel. It's just a simple spreadsheet. But anyway, on here I have the sabbaticals from 162 BCE through 3262 CE. And you can see in bold the next sabbatical, 2009, on the back page. So here we have every sabbatical for the next, 1,000 years. Turn with me now. Let's get back to the Bible, Leviticus chapter 25 again. Leviticus chapter 25, and let's look at verse 8. Verse 8. And ye shall number 7 Sabbaths of years to you, 7 times 7 years. And there shall be unto you the days of 7 Sabbaths of years, even 49 years. Then ye shall send abroad the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month, and the day of atonement. Ye shall send abroad the trumpet throughout all the land. And you shall hallow the 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the inhabitants of it. It shall be a jubilee unto you. And ye shall return every man to his possession, and ye shall return every man to his family. Now this is the Jubilee, and here we see the count to the Jubilee. For those who are familiar with the symbolism of numbers, we know that the 7 here represents perfection. My wife, her finger is perfection, so I never forget her ring size, perfection. For example, in 7 days, Yahweh created the heavens and earth. And it was good. Perfection. It's also interesting to note that the count of Jubilee is the same as the count of Pentecost, or Feast of Weeks, 7 sevens. I believe there's some symbolism or importance there, 7 sevens, perfection times perfection, perhaps. Notice in verse 9 and 10 that the Jubilee is proclaimed by the sound of a trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month. Matter of fact, the word Jubilee comes from the Hebrew word yabel, which means to blow of a horn, the blow of a horn. Now, what does it mean to proclaim the year of Jubilee? Now, what does it mean here? The word proclaim comes from the Hebrew word kara, which means to call out. I believe that this concept is akin or similar to the Sabbath or a feast day. We're called out. We're called out on a specific time. As we see here, the year of Jubilee begins with the blowing of a trumpet on Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. It seems that this would also correspond with the 7th year sabbatical. If we consider this from an agricultural point of view, this makes sense. I'm going to show you why. Beginning the sabbatical and Jubilee in the fall on Yom Kippur corresponds with the crop cycles in the Middle East. The 7th month is when Israel gathers in the fall harvest. We know this, scriptural and agricultural cycles today. In the 8th month, Israel would begin once more plowing the fields, preparing them for the next year. So it was a transitional phase in the 8th month. For example, winter barley in the Middle East is sown in the 8th month, about late October, and then harvested in the month of Abib, the first month, about mid-April, somewhere in there. It's important to understand also that Israel, the 7th month, was considered, I believe, the end of the agricultural year. I believe I can prove this in Exodus chapter 23, verse 16. Turn with me there if you would. Exodus chapter 23, verse 16. It says, at the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors which ye sow in your field, and the feast of ingathering, at the end of the year, when ye gather in the labors of your field. So it's talking about the feast of ingathering. Yahweh told Israel that when they kept the feast of ingathering, or the feast of tabernacles, which is just 2 months away now, at year's end, that they were to gather in the crops of the field. It's important to understand what Yahweh meant here when he said the end of the year, the word end. The word end is from the Hebrew word yatsah, and can mean to grow or to bring forth. So it's associated, one association anyway, with agriculture, yatsah. I believe that when Yahweh told Israel to gather in the crops at the end of the year, that he was referring to the end of the agricultural year, not the end of the sacred or civil year, as some propose. But again, we can see this corresponding with the sabbatical and Jubilee. Turn back to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25, and let's look at verse 11 now. It says, a jubilee shall that 50 year be to you. You shall not sow, neither reap that which grows of itself in it, nor gather the grapes in it of the undressed vines. For it is a jubilee that shall be holy or set apart to you. You shall eat the increase of it out of the field. In this year of Jubilee, you shall return every man to his possession, and if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy of your neighbor's hand, you shall not wrong our neighbor, one another. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy of your neighbor, and according to the number of years of the crops, you shall sell it to. In other words, they fixed the price on the years away from the Jubilee. They determined the price from the years away from the Jubilee. Verse 16, according to the multitude of the years, you shall increase the price of it, and according to the fewness of the years, you shall diminish the price of it. For the number of the crops does he sell to you. In other words, he would have more crops in a 50-year span than a 20-year span, and that would reflect in the price. And you shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your Elohim, for I am Yahweh, your Elohim. Therefore, you shall do my statutes and keep my ordinances to do them, and shall dwell in the land in safety. As we go on, we see more the seventh year and the blessings of obeying Yahweh. As we saw with the sabbatical, we also see that during the Jubilee that all debts were canceled, the slaves were liberated, and that the land was allowed to rest for one more additional year. One distinction, though, between the sabbatical and the Jubilee is that during the Jubilee, all land returned to the original owners. Since the land returned to the original family owners, land ownership, you might say, was somewhat of a foreign idea, because again, it returned every 50 years. For the Israelites, land was basically leased, was more or less leased every 50 years. Now, why was this done? Why did Yahweh command that the land be returned every Jubilee? He gave this command for the same reason he commanded to forgive debts, to release slaves. And that was for the stability of the poor and of the nation. You know, like our laws of usury in this nation, Yahweh established a system that encouraged social support for the poor and financial stability for the nation without heavy taxation. Yahweh knew what he was doing. He established a plan, a system that works. And it worked for the Israelites until they neglected it. Now, since we understand the physical requirements of the Jubilee, I'd like to ponder for just a few moments a possible prophetic meaning behind this time. We know that Paul in 2 Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, wrote that Yahweh's appointed times were a shadow of things to come, meaning that they have prophetic importance. And I believe that this holds true also for the sabbatical and Jubilee. One passage that I believe that offers many parallels between the Jubilee and Yahshua's coming in the millennium is found in Ezekiel chapter 37. Turn with me there, if you would, as a closing passage, Ezekiel chapter 37. And let's look here if we can find and see any parallels between the Jubilee, Yahshua's coming, and the millennium. Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 15. The word of Yahweh came again to me, saying, "And you, son of man, take to yourself one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for the house of Israel, his companions." One stick, Judah, representing Judah, Benjamin, part of Levi, and then yet Ephraim, representing the 10 northern tribes. "And join them for you one to another into one stick, that they may become one in your hand, bringing them together. And when the children of your people shall speak to you, saying, 'Will you not show us what you mean by these?' Say to them, 'In this manner says a sovereign Yahweh, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will put them with it, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in my hand. And the sticks on which ye write shall be in your hand before my eyes. And say to them, In this manner says a sovereign Yahweh, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the nations to which they have gone, and I will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land.'" What does that remind you of? Verse 22, "And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. One king shall be king to them all, and they shall no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all." Verse 23, "Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with their transgressions." Yahweh is going to remove them. We're going to remove the idolatry and the sin and the transgression. "But I will save them out of their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and I will cleanse them. So shall they be my people, and I will be their Elohim." Verse 24, and my servant David shall be king over them. David, again, will reign as king in the millennium. King David. And they shall all have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my ordinances and observe my statutes and do them. And they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob my servant, in which your fathers dwelt, and they shall dwell in it, they and their children, and their children's children forever, and David my servant shall be their prince forever. Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them, it shall be an everlasting covenant with them, and I will place them and multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary in the middle of them forever. My tabernacle also shall be with them, and I will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people. And the nations shall know that I am Yahweh that sanctifies Israel, with my sanctuary shall be in the middle of them forever. Here we have a picture of Yahshua's return in the millennium. We see that when Yahshua returns to this earth, that he will once again, he will bring back, it says, Judah, representing again Judah, Benjamin, and part of Levi, with Ephraim, representing the 10 northern tribes. When this happens, we also see that Yahshua will forgive their sins and will once more restore them to their own land. Again, I believe that many of these events foreshadow what we see in the Jubilee. For example, when Yahweh forgives our sins, he forgives our debts. No different from the sabbatical or Jubilee. He forgives our debts, their wrongdoings. When Yahweh brings them together, Judah and Ephraim, and restores them to their own land, the land is returned again to its rightful owner. No different from the Jubilee. The parallel between Yahshua's coming, the millennium, and the Jubilee, I believe, can clearly be seen here in Yahweh's prophetic word. Yahweh's word leaves no doubt that both the sabbatical and Jubilee are important to him. And not only that, but important to us, important to our well-being. As we've seen throughout this message, if we as his people obey his word, if we obey, we'll reap blessings, but if not, we'll reap cursings. That's the way it works. Know that this doesn't only apply to the sabbatical and Jubilee, but to all of Yahweh's commands, including his seventh day, or his feast days in the seventh month, which again will be here shortly. And I pray that all who are able, and even not able, shall come to join us there. Remember that we are Yahweh's people, and we have an obligation to obey and know and understand his word. That's why it's important to cover these issues, so that we understand the sabbatical, the Jubilee. I pray that we will think upon Yahweh's appointed times, including the sabbatical Jubilee, and as his people, defer not to ignore our obligations. May Yahweh bless you.
You know, it's interesting that the land would return to each of the tribes, and in Revelation 21, you read about the great city, the New Jerusalem, coming down, and the 12 gates, three on each side, north, south, east, and west, right in the middle of that, with the gates of the 12 tribes of Israel, the names written on those gates, so that that land is still there, still promised to the 12 tribes, and each of us enters through one of the gates into the city.
And also, Yeshua's birth was around 2 B.C. I believe in one of the Sabbath years, it was 28 B.C., and it said he was